I next met with Dr. Hope Rugo, and as discussed with Dr. Blackwell, one key topic was Dr. Rugo's ASCO presentation of a Phase 3 CALGB trial, 40502, in metastatic breast cancer.
We wanted to find out whether or not the newer microtubule inhibitors would be superior to the older one, paclitaxel, our old standby. And so we planned to randomize 900 women who had chemotherapy-naive metastatic, in general HER2-normal breast cancer to receive either weekly paclitaxel, weekly nab-paclitaxel, or weekly ixabepilone. Now, we designed this study right after ECOG 2100 reported their data demonstrating superiority when bevacizumab was added to weekly paclitaxel compared to paclitaxel alone in the same patient population. So we gave bevacizumab to every patient enrolled on the trial. About two-thirds of the way, three-quarters of the way through the trial, when the ODAC recommended that approval for bevacizumab be withdrawn, we actually allowed patients and their physicians to decide not to receive bevacizumab, but 98% of patients on the trial received bevacizumab regardless. So the goal of the trial was to see whether or not, when we compared nab-paclitaxel or ixabepilone to paclitaxel, but not to each other, whether one of them would be superior in terms of progression-free survival, or potentially be equivalent and have less toxicity. And this idea came from trials that suggested that these drugs might be able to overcome known resistance mechanisms to paclitaxel and other microtubule inhibitors. The doses that were chosen were complicated because both drugs, ixabepilone and nab-paclitaxel, like paclitaxel, were approved in every three-week dosing schedules. So what did we show? Well, the trial actually closed the ixabepilone arm a little bit early because of futility, and then the entire trial closed early because of futility. We enrolled 799 patients instead of 900. And it turned out that ixabepilone was inferior to paclitaxel, so progression-free survival was actually shorter. Nab-paclitaxel was no better. And duration of response appeared to be shorter with both experimental agents. Interestingly, the dose of ixabepilone appeared to be low enough that we didn't see a lot of hematologic toxicity, but neurologic toxicity was higher for both experimental arms. In other words, peripheral and even a little bit of motor neuropathy. The bone marrow toxicity or hematologic toxicity was greater for nab-paclitaxel as well compared to paclitaxel. So what we saw was these newer agents that had offered the promise of being able to reverse resistance, at least in this patient population and at this dose and schedule, were not superior. And it appeared that paclitaxel, and in 98% of the patients given with bevacizumab, was as good or better than the newer agents.
Did you feel a sense of disappointment with what was found? I mean, this was a huge effort, very important trial. And do you think that maybe trials like this, looking at chemotherapy, are kind of on their way out?
Of course, we're very disappointed. We like to have a winner, but I think that in this trial, we do have a winner. What we want to do in patients with metastatic breast cancer is to spare toxicity and to get the best efficacy to help patients live as long as possible with the best quality of life. That is our goal for the treatment of advanced breast cancer. And by doing this trial, where we were able to incorporate futility analyses and enroll more than 100 less patients than we originally started out to enroll, we were able to teach people a lot about what the appropriate therapy is for patients. So I think that as long as we have new agents, we need to be comparing them to the old. We didn't have a hypothesis, and we don't as of now, to suggest that one subpopulation would benefit more than another. And that's part of the exploratory correlative work that will go on in the future with the tumor samples from patients enrolled in this trial. But I actually think that as long as we have new agents, we need to be very careful that we're not replacing the old with the new until we're sure they're better and at least have the same toxicity.
I know you've told me in the past there have been patients in situations outside a trial setting where you use nab-paclitaxel, and most people have used a lower dose than the 150 per meter squared used in the trial. Are you still using this agent?
Yes, absolutely. I think nab-paclitaxel definitely has an important place in the treatment of patients with advanced breast cancer, patients who can't tolerate the solvent cremaphore, who can't tolerate steroids. If we are using the lower dose at 100 milligrams per meter squared data from phase 2 trials published by Joanne Blum suggested that the peripheral neuropathy rate with that dosing schedule was actually fairly low. So in patients who have pre-existing peripheral neuropathy, I'll often choose that lower dose of nab-paclitaxel because I'm avoiding the additional toxicity of cremaphore. But I had never really given that higher dose, and I certainly wouldn't now.
What about steroids? We talk about patients you want to avoid steroids in. What about a patient, for example, with type 2 diabetes, easy to control, but maybe somebody you really don't want to see on steroids?
Well, that's another good situation. Certainly, it's difficult in the adjuvant setting because it's not approved in that situation. But in patients who have, for example, have not the kind you're talking about, but somebody who really has bad diabetes and out of control, I have successfully argued to insurance companies that it's not a good idea to give them steroids weekly, and they get nab-paclitaxel. People are allergic to cremaphore. And then in the metastatic setting, the patients who I give nab-paclitaxel to do indeed have that kind of a situation. So somebody who has diabetes and it's sort of controlled, but you really don't want to push them over to give them insulin, which is really going to affect their quality of life. And I find that a lot of those patients, their glucose control is kind of quasi-good anyway.
So my favorite question asker, Dr. Stephen Vogel, I know right after your presentation asked, I thought was a pretty good question, which was, you know, just taking a step back, you mentioned that almost all these patients ended up getting bevacizumab, and he pointed out that the results seemed to confirm the initial findings of the original ECOG 2100 study looking at paclitaxel bevacizumab. Do you agree with that?
Yes, and I would say that Dr. Vogel always asks good questions, really, and that's why he's so revered. Indeed, I thought that was really intriguing that our data in a very similar patient population showed an almost identical progression-free survival to that shown in the experimental arm of ECOG 2100. The paclitaxel plus bevacizumab arm was just about the same PFS rate, a little over 11 months. So in some ways, it validates those findings a little bit. We didn't obviously have an arm without bevacizumab, so we have no comparison. But I certainly remain convinced that there's a patient population that benefits from bevacizumab.
You talked about using assays to try to figure out who's going to do well, but also in terms of responding to therapy. And we have gotten used to using the Oncotype in invasive breast cancer, but now there have been some data that are coming out in DCIS. What are your thoughts about that?
Well, it's interesting because the recurrence score really was the first test we had, albeit for early stage disease, that was a predictor of response. Unfortunately, it didn't help us predict whether you responded to ACT or TC. It just helped us understand who might benefit more from chemotherapy. And that in and of itself, of course, when it happened, and even now, is a very critical question for patients with ER-positive early stage breast cancer. The DCIS question is interesting because for DCIS, we're not deciding should a patient get chemotherapy and lose their hair and be sick for a few months and take a while to recover or not. We're really trying harder to decide what to do, how much to do. So we were able to get over the barrier and say, even though you have a 2-centimeter tumor, your recurrence score is really low, so we're going to not give you chemotherapy. And hopefully over time, and with more data, we're going to be able to make similar decisions for DCIS and say, look, you have a really low-risk DCIS. You don't need to have a big surgery and radiation. Maybe you can just have resection. Maybe there are some patients where you do a core biopsy and we should just watch them. You know, a 75-year-old patient who has not as long to live as a 35-year-old patient who has a very slow-growing DCIS probably could have a fairly conservative, minimalist approach to management. So I see that's where the DCIS score is going. It's really going to help us understand who needs less rather than doing less for everybody.
Are there situations where you use this Oncotype DCIS score?
Well, I actually try very hard not to see patients with DCIS if I could avoid it, because I found that anxiety and concern generally are inversely proportional to risk. But I think that there are patients where we might consider sending a score, a nuclear grade 2 tumor, you know, DCIS with necrosis, and you're really trying to decide if you should do a more aggressive surgery, whether or not a patient who really doesn't want radiation therapy should have a mastectomy, or maybe they can just have a lumpectomy and watchful waiting. In the past, we made these decisions based on clinical and pathologic criteria. And if we have something else that we can add in, so much the better. I remember having a patient when I first started in breast cancer and was working with Laura Esserman, who has been a big proponent to really thinking outside of the box and challenging some of the long-term suppositions that we've had. She said, I'd rather die than lose my breast. And I remember being quite taken aback by it, but then really looking at the clinical picture with Laura's help and understanding that this patient had very low-grade ductal carcinoma in situ and some LCIS at the margins, and that doing a mastectomy probably would do very little to help her to live longer or have a better quality of life. In fact, it might destroy her in many ways. So doing radiation for this patient after a long discussion with the radiation oncologist and then hormone therapy turned out to be a very appropriate management. She's many, many years out now. And you know, if you need to have another surgery later, that's not the end of the world.
So speaking of Laura Esserman, I wanted to ask you what's up with the I-SPY trial. I can't remember if it was ASCA or a paper I saw recently on that that you were part of.
It may have been a paper talking about I-SPY 1, the results of I-SPY 1. There's also been a lot of press and a paper talking about using neoadjuvant therapy, not just as a initial indicator of potential efficacy of targeted agents, but potentially as a pathway towards drug approval of novel agents. So the I-SPY 1 trial looked at neoadjuvant therapy with MRI imaging and serial biopsies, and then building on that trial, we have the multi-centered I-SPY 2 trial, which is sponsored by the Foundation of the National Institute of Health. And what that trial does is uses a backbone of weekly paclitaxel for 12 weeks, followed by doxorubicin and cyclophosphamide, followed by surgery for patients who have tumors at least 2 centimeters or larger, and adds in a series of novel agents. HER2-positive disease is treated slightly differently than HER2-negative disease because those patients can get randomized to trastuzumab as their standard agent or have a drug added to trastuzumab or have a substitute like neratinib. And then they receive trastuzumab postoperatively. But patients have serial biopsies, they have MRIs, and we've had a number of novel agents go into the project already. The study is open at least 22 institutions in the United States and has screened and randomized a large number of patients. I think one of the really important things about this trial design is that we screen patients for the predictor of response to neoadjuvant chemotherapy. So you have actually a core biopsy sent for mammoprint testing, and if you're low risk, you're not eligible to go on I-SPY 2. Now, you might as a clinician still treat them with chemotherapy, and we have a registry study that my colleague is running for that purpose. You might enroll them in a separate trial, but I-SPY 2 is designed for the patients who have the most rapidly growing, most aggressive tumors, at least as measured by mammoprint.
Right. It is the JCO had the paper that just came out a few weeks ago, I-SPY 1, as you said. Any other tissue predictors that are being incorporated or thought about in terms of I-SPY?
Well, there is a bunch of very smart people who actually, this trial is organized with a lot of different committees so that one person doesn't control the data. The pharmaceutical partners play a role in discussing biomarkers, but they don't control the biomarkers either. So very smart people who are experts in this area discuss a variety of biomarkers for each agent. Tissue is collected. There is a evaluation, statistical evaluation, as you're going along during the trial that Don Barry is running. And what that does is it allows you to drop drugs that are clearly not benefiting patients, but also to potentially identify subsets who might benefit as you go along. And then you can actually adapt your biomarkers to new data that comes up that you think, well, really, I should be checking this biomarker for that drug. You set some up in advance, but then they're designed to be changed as you go along as well. And, you know, maybe at the end you could come out with data that would look like in the ideal setting, oh, we have experimental drug X that we added to T. We stop it when we get to the AC. And we were able to show that in patients who have this gene signature, that there's, you know, a benefit. Then you could do potentially a more definitive study, and the two together would lead to enough data to allow FDA approval in that subset.
You mentioned that the I-SPY trial required a high mammoprint signature. Are there any situations right now, we've seen data in the neoadjuvant setting with Oncotype out of Italy, I'm not sure there's been anything else, where you think it'd be reasonable to consider this outside a trial setting to make a decision about neoadjuvant chemo?
You're asking specifically about the recurrence score?
Mm-hmm.
So, yes, I do think so. And in fact, sometimes, you know, we've gotten a recurrence score to try and further define the mammoprint because, you know, there's a lot of correlation between the two tests, but you get that middle category with the recurrence score, which sometimes can be helpful in making decisions. But I do think so. I mean, I've had patients who had very low mammoprint, very low Oncotype, if you got it, but low mammoprint, had a low-grade, strongly ERPR-positive tumor, and I've used that information to say, okay, you don't qualify for I-SPY 2, but neoadjuvant hormone therapy might help you get a better surgical result. And also, you know, although we don't know how to validate that, Matt Ellis has done some work in this area, maybe it could tell us something about the biology of your tumor. So in Matt Ellis's ACOSOG trial, the Ki-67 at the time of surgery was predictive of outcome. And another trial is planned, actually, with Cynthia Maz, the principal investigator, that will look at this as well and give us even, I think, a more definitive answer. So that, for example, you give a patient who's a likely candidate neoadjuvant hormone therapy, if they have a great response, or even if they just have a low Ki-67 at the time of surgery, potentially you could avoid chemotherapy.
It doesn't seem like there are too many new agents outside the HER2 world, but there is everolimus, and you were involved with the Bolero 2 trial. Can you talk about that and where you see that heading?
That was a very exciting study, actually. I think it surprised even the steering committee with the significance of the results. Basically, that although we had worked hard to try and find biomarkers, tissue biomarkers, that would help us understand who might respond better to adding mTOR inhibition with everolimus to standard hormone therapy, it turned out that the clinical characteristics were more important. We never found a biomarker. That still remains to be determined. But what we found was that if you take patients whose cancers have progressed on an aromatase inhibitor and use a second-line aromatase inhibitor, in this case exemestane, the steroidal AI, that you've already selected out a group of patients who may have activation of this pathway, so that patients who received everolimus versus those who did not enjoyed a much longer progression-free survival. There have been less deaths in that arm, but as yet we haven't reached the survival endpoint. Also, intriguingly, there appear to be some bone effects from everolimus with preservation of bone density as opposed to the bone loss that we're so used to seeing with aromatase inhibitors based on bone markers collected on the trial. There is toxicity from the mTOR inhibitors in general, and I think we have to be very aware of those toxicities. And as this drug becomes more available and is FDA approved, which we hope to happen in the not too distant future, be sure that people are educated about how to dose reduce and hold drug when patients get mouth sores, and to look for interstitial pneumonitis, which is a rare but a real side effect that you just need to be aware of and hold drug for. So where this got us, as opposed to the details of that study, is the first trial that showed us that we could actually reverse hormone resistance. And that, I think, is very exciting. What we need to do, though, and that's outside of the HER2 field. We already knew about HER2, but that's 15 to 20% of breast cancer patients. The rest of them, we really didn't know that other than changing hormone therapies, we could reverse resistance. Now we had a rational combination. We saw that we could improve outcome. Well, what we'd really like to do is to prevent relapse and death in these patients who develop resistance rapidly or have upfront resistance to hormone therapy. That, I think, is a little more of an elusive goal, but we're certainly marching in that direction. A trial is planned adding everolimus to patients with higher risk ER-positive early-stage breast cancer, but I think that, you know, we're desperate, really, to find the subgroup of patients who benefit, and I think that's going to be critical moving forward.
You mentioned the pneumonitis. How much of an issue is it, particularly when combined with hormonal therapy, and how do you screen patients for this?
So pneumonitis turns out to be not anywhere near as much of an issue as we feared it might be. It really occurs in 1% or less of patients, and usually it's quite mild. The screening initially in these trials, we did screening chest x-rays periodically, but turned out that that wasn't really all that helpful. If a patient has a cough or has changes, interstitial changes on a CT scan and they're asymptomatic, then I think you need to be watching them very carefully with a cough, certainly holding drug. And it turns out that if you dose reduce, many patients go back on again and really don't have a problem again.
Any explanation for why a prior study looking at TEM sirolimus didn't really seem to show anything?
You know, the patient population was quite different in that TEM sirolimus study, and I've looked into it in some detail and talked to Antonio Wolf, who's working on putting that data together for publication this year. The data was initially presented in a meeting a number of years ago. But that trial tried to enroll 1,000 patients who had hormone therapy naive metastatic ER-positive breast cancer, and they got letrozole, the aromatase inhibitor letrozole, or letrozole plus TEM sirolimus. At the time, it's kind of similar to giving weekly exabeplone in the previous study I talked about, that maybe the dose and schedule of TEM sirolimus wasn't ideal. They don't really know, but what's true is that there wasn't a lot of stomatitis, which is almost like a marker of dose intensity for the mTOR inhibitors. And potentially that's a reason. Also, the first line patients may not have had enough activation of this pathway. At the time the trial was done, AIs, aromatase inhibitors, really weren't being given for early stage breast cancer. And so these patients had disease which hadn't previously been exposed to aromatase inhibitors largely. So some of them have very slow growing, very hormone responsive disease and could stay on first line hormone therapy for a number of years. And in that situation, I think you might need 3,000 patients to be able to be powered to see a difference. And they reached their futility endpoint and unblinded the study early.
Now, I know there's a trial out there, Bolero-1, looking at everolimus and HER2-positive disease. Any thoughts about that strategy? And what about in triple-negative breast cancer?
So there's actually two studies, Bolero-1 and Bolero-3, first-line and later-line therapy, adding everolimus to trastuzumab. There is data that suggests in a phase 2 trial that's been published in the JCO that shows that when you added everolimus to trastuzumab and taxane chemotherapy in patients whose cancers were progressing, that you could see a reasonable number of patients whose disease stopped progressing or even responded. So we know that mTOR inhibition has at least some ability to counter resistance to trastuzumab in HER2-positive breast cancers. Where it's going to go is another question. I think because we have a wealth of riches treating HER2-positive disease with the recent approval of pertuzumab, and it's expected that amtansine, T-DM1, will follow close behind, and then a number of other agents. Nonetheless, I think we don't want to turn away any potentially effective agent, and these small molecules cross the blood-brain barrier, which may provide some kind of a unique niche in terms of treating metastatic resistant HER2-positive breast cancer. So I think that remains to be seen. You also asked about triple-negative breast cancer, and there's, of course, been interest in using a number of different agents like this for triple-negative breast cancer, and I think we'll see more data. I don't hold out a lot of hope that mTOR inhibition in and of itself will be an effective strategy to treat triple-negative breast cancer.
Just finishing out on Bolero-2, the benefits of exemestane in the control arm and in other studies has been not too impressive in patients who have prior non-steroidal AIs. Do you think it's really contributing anything to this combination, or you'd see the same results with everolimus?
I do think the hormone therapy is contributing something to this combination, but of course, I don't have that answer. That's my opinion, because we didn't have an arm with everolimus alone in this specific trial. Everolimus has been tested as a single agent, and a study done in Canada looked at everolimus alone, and there was a low level of responses, but it was a very low level. So I think that in the preclinical setting, it appears to be important to have the hormone therapy with everolimus. Certainly, I think with the newer agents that are being tested, there's been a lot of interest in trying to look at targeted therapies alone and see whether or not they are just as effective. But if everolimus and exemestane are approved as a combination, as is expected, everybody's going to have that as a watermark to try and compare themselves to. So we may not actually get to that.
You mentioned T-DM1, and of course, we saw the Amelia trial presented at ASCO. I'd like you to reflect back on what your take was on that study, and then maybe we can chat a little bit about taking care of patients with HER2-positive disease today with pertuzumab available, and as you say, probably T-DM1 pretty soon.
Yes, T-DM1, I think, is a fascinating agent, and it's, I think, from the oncologist standpoint, it's a cool drug. the smart bomb approach, that's what you hear and heard after that talk, the idea that you could target a toxin directly to the cancer cell and really minimize systemic toxicity is, I think, the sort of end game for all of oncology in the long run. And this isn't perfect, but I think it gets us a long way there. It is trastuzumab, and it's linked, of course, to this toxin amtansine, which can't be given by itself because it's way too toxic. The toxicities are an increase in liver enzymes and a decrease in platelets, which are self-limited. And generally, very few patients need to be dose-reduced, an occasional number. And some of the patients that I treated on the first couple of phase 2 trials, as well as the dose expansion trial, those patients, I had 3 who stayed on for well over 3 years. So clearly, you can actually take the drug for a long period of time and tolerate it. So I have to say that the tolerability of T-DM1 in the Amelia trial was no surprise for those of us who participated in the earlier phase 2 trials. I think the efficacy, the superiority over lapatinib and capecitabine was very exciting for us because for patients who get lapatinib and capecitabine, it's a lot to do. You know, we're not getting rid of that. It's still our friend. I mean, we still want to have multiple treatment options, but to not have to give it right up front is great when patients progress on trastuzumab. You know, they have to take the lapatinib all at once on an empty stomach, so that's difficult. You have to worry about any other medication they take that can interfere with absorption or metabolism. And then, of course, capecitabine causes the hand-foot syndrome, which is so disrupting to quality of life, albeit not life-threatening. And then the combination of the two makes bowel movements unpredictable. So that also affects quality of life. And this is a time when, you know, your days are very important. So we're very excited about the T-DM1 results and looking forward to having it available and moving it into the early stage setting.
You mentioned the MARIANNE trial. Can you talk about what that's looking at? And you kind of put one and one together in terms of pertuzumab with chemo and trastuzumab, and you start thinking about T-DM1 pertuzumab.
Well, and that's exactly what the MARIANNE study is doing. It's a complicated study. It has 4 arms, and it adds T-DM1 into the mix with pertuzumab to try and see whether or not we could actually give the antibody plus the chemo as T-DM1, and then add the pertuzumab. So you'd have a Cleopatra-like design, but you wouldn't have hair loss, and you wouldn't have the decrease in blood counts, and some of the other systemic toxicities that we all hate, you know, fingernails falling off, epiphora with the tearing, and fibrosis of the tear duct. And for patients, hair loss really can't be emphasized enough. It's a really big deal for patients who have metastatic disease to feel like they're going to die of their cancer anyway, although some with HER2-positive disease may not, and they have to lose their hair. It can be an enormous barrier to overcome.
And I guess we'll have to wait and see if and when T-DM1 is approved, but if it were available now, can you envision situations where you would use, if you could get it paid for, T-DM1 and pertuzumab together outside a trial?
It's a good question. I think that I would be hesitant to do that. I understand the appeal, but from where I stand right now, I would be hesitant to do that. We have the great data from Cleopatra showing that if you add pertuzumab in the first-line setting, that you can improve progression-free survival response and probably survival, although it's too early to know for sure. Very little toxicity, and that data is solid. We don't know that T-DM1 and pertuzumab in the first-line setting is going to be equivalent. So could I see maybe in a late-line patient where we're really trying to get a good response, adding pertuzumab because those patients will not have had the benefit of pertuzumab in the first-line setting? Potentially. But that requires the T-DM1 get approved and the insurance companies allow you to do that combination, as you pointed out. But I can see that once it's approved, if we have some patients who are very long-term survivors with HER2-positive disease, that we might be sort of coaxed into using that, at least trying to use that combination.
Any comments on the toxicities, particularly the paper toxicities of T-DM1, specifically thrombocytopenia and liver enzyme elevations?
So the liver enzyme elevations are interesting. It actually was the dose-limiting toxicity for maytansine when it was given as a naked drug. It really caused a lot of transaminitis, hepatitis. So now the most we usually see is AST, ALT in the sort of 120 range. It's usually self-limited. It comes down. The patients I had on for a number of years kind of chronically have a slight elevation in their transaminases sitting in the 80, 90, 100 range. And we just learned not to worry about it because when the drug stopped, one of the three patients progressed at 3.5 years, her enzymes immediately went down to normal. Platelets are an interesting issue. I had one patient who was on the phase 2 trial. You know, we were checking platelets every week, which we wouldn't normally do in patients treated off a trial where they'll get TDM1 every 3 weeks. But her platelets nadired at 17,000, and she had a nosebleed. But that is extremely rare. It was very rare in the Amelia trial, and it was uncommon in the heavily pretreated patients treated on the two phase 2 studies. So I think that in general, we should just instruct patients about risks, tell them it's uncommon, and follow them along. In general, the platelet nadir, again, is at least when they want to get dosed again at 3 weeks, is kind of in the 80, 90,000 range, but most patients are over 100,000. So we followed patients. They never really fell, but they never really went back up to normal. And when we stopped drug, some patients' platelets immediately went back up to normal, and some patients took a little bit longer.
I'm not sure if I'm remembering this correctly in terms of transaminitis, but I thought I remember Dr. Blackwell talking about dose-reducing TDM1 for that.
That's right. And actually, very good point to bring up. You know, the standard dose that we dose every 3 weeks, there will be a guideline when this is approved to dose-reduce if you have a significant transaminitis. I just want to mention that you dose-reduce TDM1 for thrombocytopenia as well. That's significant. So that'll all become clearer when there is a label. It'll follow the study guidelines.
So I'm curious what you're doing nowadays in terms of pertuzumab. Are you attempting to use it? Have you been able to use it? And when you are using it, what chemo are you using?
Pertuzumab, exciting drug, and obviously it's going to add to the expense of care. So right now, I think that there are two settings where we're most likely to use it. One, of course, is in the first line setting, and I've already put in for authorization for two patients, one of whom is already authorized. I'm hoping to treat her later this week. Adding it to TCH, actually, so it answers one of your questions to docetaxel carboplatin and trastuzumab that she received. She presented with a large primary lesion and a bone lesion. So she has metastatic disease at diagnosis. She's responding well, but it's kind of a perfect situation in my mind to add pertuzumab late. I think I would start new patients with pertuzumab along with their standard chemo, but generally we use a lot of paclitaxel, and I would feel very comfortable using pertuzumab with paclitaxel and trastuzumab. I don't feel that I need to use it with docetaxel. The second place where we might add it is in patients who are progressing on trastuzumab and chemotherapy, have received lapatinib, et cetera. In a phase 2 trial, adding pertuzumab appeared to result in fairly impressive efficacy, and some of it was quite durable. So in patients who hadn't had the benefit of being able to be exposed to pertuzumab up front, I would use it as later line therapy, and I certainly would feel comfortable giving it in combination with chemotherapy as well in that setting.
So do we know or do you have any thoughts about whether you're going to actually be able to do what you just said? For example, use paclitaxel, which theoretically, at least in terms of the label, it says docetaxel, and use it later line. Again, the label says first HER2 therapy for metastatic disease.
Well, I'm hopeful that we will be able to make a good case for that to insurance companies. And obviously, it remains to be seen. The NCCN is currently meeting and discussing guidelines, and they're always taking new data, of course, every year for the breast committee to decide what they're going to recommend. And we'll wait and see what the NCCN breast committee recommends, because I think that will be helpful if they're able to be agnostic about the type of taxane, that will help us all get insurance approval for using either paclitaxel or docetaxel.
We've kind of moved towards a paradigm in HER2-positive metastatic disease of continuing anti-HER therapy indefinitely, for example, keeping trastuzumab going and switching the chemotherapy. I've had oncologists ask me, what about keeping the pertuzumab, trastuzumab going and switching the chemo, sort of thinking for the future?
It's a good question and one I think we've all pondered over. I think that we don't know yet. If survival is truly better in the CLEOPATRA trial when they have all of the events, which I think we suspect it will be, and they stopped pertuzumab at progression, then it may make sense to stop pertuzumab. I think that the cost of care is going to be enormous if we continue pertuzumab through multiple lines of progression, and we don't have any data to support it. Obviously, the next study will be to look at whether it makes a difference or not to continue pertuzumab through progression, along with all of the early stage trials. But I think that we probably shouldn't continue it for the life of the patient until we know whether or not it's going to help them.
So with all the excitement about particularly these two new agents, what's going on in terms of discussion about the next generation of adjuvant trials? Things have gotten very, very complicated all of a sudden. What's the thinking about T-DM1 and pertuzumab?
Well, pertuzumab, of course, has been incorporated into an ongoing adjuvant trial called the AFFINITY trial, which is open internationally and is accruing quite nicely. That trial is looking at exactly sort of the CLEOPATRA idea, but it's adding pertuzumab to either paclitaxel or docetaxel type of based chemotherapy. So that will give us some more data as well, which I think is going to be helpful. Also, it requires patients with a little more cancer. So one idea that Dana-Farber has had, which we're very enthusiastic about, is to use T-DM1 in smaller HER2-positive cancers where, you know, we want to give them a little therapy that includes a HER2-targeted agent. If you could give them a short course of T-DM1, they don't even lose their hair, that would be fabulous. And I think the real question is going to be taking that leap.
So this is sort of son of or daughter of the paclitaxel trastuzumab regimen they tried out at Dana-Farber.
Yes, that's right. We all participated in that trial and we're hoping to see data from that study next year. It's not quite ready yet, not enough events, which is a study which isn't ready to be reported because it doesn't have enough events, a single arm phase 2 trial. That's kind of a good thing in and of itself.
Totally. So I hardly ask this question anymore, but I used to ask it all the time, but I think I'll just throw it out anyhow. Anything new in terms of hormonal therapy, either in the adjuvant or metastatic setting? Seems like it's been a while other than trying to add new agents such as everolimus, but anything in terms of hormonal treatment?
Well, you know, we're waiting to understand more about the appropriate duration of aromatase inhibitors. Lots of data waiting to come out, but patients stay on hormone therapy for a long time. And for some reason, the people we see all the time are those for whom hormone therapy doesn't work. So that's who we have front in our mind. So the biggest really news that we've had is fulvestrant being better at 500 milligrams and with a loading dose. And that, I think, has made a difference in treating patients. The use of estradiol at 2 milligrams 3 times a day, I think, is also beneficial for patients with very hormone-responsive disease. And then the trial that looked at, the SWOG trial that looked at the combination of anastrozole and fulvestrant, I haven't really seen that picked up much, you know, in terms of treatment of patients, mainly because it's just a lot for the patients to do. And those patients were kind of unique. Most had metastatic disease at presentation and hadn't had prior hormone therapy.
So another question I want to throw out to you that we used to ask a lot, and I haven't asked too often, it's not even breast cancer specific, but I received an email from an oncologist, Dr. Richard Lloyd, who asked this, and I see that you are on the NCCN Committee of Anti-Emesis. So let me just tell you what he says. Do HT3 antagonists differ in efficacy? Do cost issues affect your prescription of antiemetics? What's your preferred regimen for highly emetogenic chemotherapy and moderately emetogenic therapy?
Well, they're very good questions. And generally, we prescribe what we think is the best regimen, and then we deal with the cost issues as a secondary issue. For example, a patient who can't, you know, I want to give amend to, who can't afford it, has a high copay, I give IV fosaprepitant. So that's one kind of nice way to get around that at the moment. I believe that the data that's available shows that, in general, palonosetron is a superior agent for highly emetogenic chemotherapy, and that the combination of palonosetron, amend, and dexamethasone is a great cocktail for patients getting anthracyclines with cyclophosphamide, where we really struggle with getting patients through their treatment. And then, of course, we use rescue medication as well. We need to not be forgetting to use dexamethasone. And I think that that reflects the current guidelines, but certainly, you can give a high dose of vondansetron as an IV medication, as well as the other 5-HT3 antagonists that are shorter acting. For moderately emetogenic chemotherapy, I think it's harder to say. And in that situation, I really individualize it for patients. So if they have a lot of nausea and vomiting, I tend to go the full court press. If they're tolerating treatment well with my initial start with using ondansetron and I'd say a dexamethasone, I won't escalate.
Yeah, Dr. Lloyd also notes the same preference you have for palonosetron, aprepitant, and dexamethasone, but states, quote, "Non-oncologists reviewing cost concerns have objected to the routine use of this admittedly more expensive therapy." I wasn't aware of that. Is that really the case?
I haven't ever had anybody object, actually. I think that if people are unfortunate enough to get breast cancer and need anthracycline or large-dose carboplatin-based chemotherapy, I don't think we should be making them throw up because we're not giving them the best therapy. And nausea is a very insidious thing. This delayed nausea associated with AC is really terrible for patients, and they're miserable. They can't get anything done. It takes them longer to recover. And, you know, we've had situations where patients had Boerhaave's tear and had to go to the ER or be admitted. And then for patients who really have refractory nausea, and we saw, of course, more of those before we have our current group of drugs, we would bring them in every day and give them IV therapy. So that's certainly not cost effective at all, or good use of the scarce infusion beds.